One Florida lawmaker wants to see tougher restrictions on cosmetic surgeons in Miami. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Republican State Senator Ana Terra Flores is pushing a bill in response to a USA Today investigation. It looked at a series of deaths at specific cosmetic surgery clinics in Miami-Dade. We'll talk to her about her idea for regulation to keep patients safe. Also, we'll get her thoughts on the governor's budget and education spending. Plus, a massive seagrass die-off in Biscayne Bay is raising concerns among public officials about the health of our water. Also, Miami Beach was a very different place in the 1970s. A new book and documentary look at the large Jewish senior community that blossomed during the quiet years of that era. And Micro Theater Miami has been offering a unique experience for more than 5 years. It's now offering a new series starting this week with shows that look at what it means to be a Miamian. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, Florida's economy has remained pretty strong in lockstep with the national economy for about a decade, and that has some folks worried that we're overdue for a reversal at some point. Amy Baker, the Florida legislature's chief economist, warned legislators recently. But for now, lawmakers in Tallahassee are preparing for another year with a growing budget and growing revenue. Now, the session begins March 5th. Joining us now is Republican State Senator Ana Terra Flores from District 39, covering southern Miami-Dade and Monroe counties. And she's proposed new legislation to address the dangers faced by surgical clinics in Florida. A new report from USA Today found one business alone in Miami had 8 deaths over 6 years. Senator Flores, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And by the way, just to mention, she's joining us from the WFSU studios in Tallahassee. And if you have a question for your senator about the upcoming session, we'd love to hear from you. What do you want lawmakers to tackle most in this upcoming session? 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. You can always post your question on Facebook or Twitter, and we will pick some of those questions to read today. Senator, let's start with Governor Ron DeSantis proposing the largest budget in Florida history, $91.3 billion. He's seeking to achieve this without significantly raising taxes. Now, when you look at the budget in its totality, where do you believe will be some of the greatest funding challenges?
Well, I'll start off by saying I think that Governor DeSantis's proposal came as a surprise to several people. I think it came as a bit of a surprise to people on the right because of its size. It's, as you mentioned, it is the largest budget that has been proposed. Also came as a surprise to some of his critics on the left because of his funding, where his funding he wants to prioritize, namely education, K-12 education, and the environment. Of course, the governor's proposal is just that. It's a proposal. It will be up to the legislature to fund and decide what the final budget will look like. But first off, his budget, I think, has been very promising, particularly when it comes to the issue of funding K-12 education. He proposes an increase of over $200 per student. That translates into millions and millions of dollars for students across the state, for students in South Florida as well. We've seen that education is a priority for Governor DeSantis, not just on the campaign trail, but now in his budget proposal. And so as we sift through these things, you know, there'll be some proposals that we'll keep, some that we won't. I will say, I think the legislature will be hard-pressed to fund less than the governor's proposed increase in education.
When you look at it, what do you like and what don't you like about it?
Well, you know, I like on education, if we stick there for a second, I like that the governor has proposed eliminating some of the more controversial pieces as it relates to the best and brightest teacher bonus program. This was a bonus program that had been highly criticized as a way of giving teachers bonuses based on their own personal SAT and ACT scores. It was a pet project of the Speaker Corcoran. He's now the Commissioner of Education. But the governor, knowing that that was very controversial, said, you know, we need to change that. So he has proposed teacher bonuses in a different way. We don't have all the details yet, but he won't be putting those on SAT and ACT. So I think that that's a really great program. Another thing hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but I really like, is he's proposed a sort of a scholarship program for students that are in college that are real close to graduating, but face financial needs. And so we have some students that, you know, they're getting the good grades, they're doing well, they're about to graduate either with their AA degree or with their bachelor's degree, and they just don't have the money to finish up those last credits. And so the governor recognizes that that's a problem and has made a presentation to say, you know, we should address this. So really, so far, everyone's kind of looking at it as good. Yeah.
All right. Again, the number is 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Again, your thoughts. What are your thoughts on the governor's plans for education spending? If you're a teacher, if you're in education, what do you think about that? Do you think it's enough, or should there be more? Or maybe you don't like it. Maybe it should be as it is. Again, 800-743-9576. Staying on education real quickly. Yes, he is proposing an increase on per pupil spending. Let's just focus on that for the moment. And it has been going up every session. Mm-hmm. But looking at different groups, I was looking just at this one in PolitiFact. We're still way below what pre-recession numbers were. We'd have to be spending over $8,700 per student to get up to anything close to what with inflation. Why has this been a struggle for legislators to get the per pupil spending up?
It's a combination of you know, the economic realities that the recession hit us very, very hard. Before the recession, we had record high level funding for K-12 education. And so the fact is that it's just taken us a long time to get back to that point. You combine that with the tragedy that happened in Parkland almost a year ago to the day, where the legislature had to have a response, had to have a very strong response. And while there was $400 million spent on the post-Parkland solution, and a lot of that is going to our schools, much of what's going to our schools is restricted funding, in the sense of it has to be used for mental health counseling, for school counselors, for school hardening. So some of the critics and the pushbacks have said, rightfully so, that while, yes, education funding last year did go up, that unrestricted portion did not go up by that much.
Right.
Something that this governor's changing.
School safety now an issue. Let's move into the fact that we are now coming up on the one-year anniversary of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas tragedy. Do you believe that the Marjory Stoneman Douglas Act went far enough or not far enough in your eyes? What did you think of it?
Look, this is a long-term problem, because the issue is there is no silver bullet to stop tragedies like this from happening in the future. I think that the legislature, a good part in the legislature's response was on the parts of school hardening. I think that's something that's very important. There are things that we can be doing to make our school structures safer. I think that where we still have a way to go is on the issue of mental health in its totality. While there is funding and increased funding for school counselors, for mental health counseling, in this the bill that was passed last year, we still have a long way to go. Part of that is because as a nation, we continue to struggle with the issue of mental health. You know, mental health was not seen as a public health risk or something that people even wanted to talk about openly up until very recently. So we as a community, but I would say as a nation, still have a long way to deal with on the issue of mental health in its totality.
That's a big part of it. Let's come back to the school safety, though. I want to talk about campus safety specifically. This morning on the Sunshine Economy, we heard two Parkland parents talk about this, and they were asked, do you feel like, you know, schools are safe, like that your kids are safe? And no, they're not feeling it. They're not. They don't believe yet that this could happen again. But how do you feel right now? Do you think that campuses are safe? What do we need to do more of?
I think we have some campuses that are very safe and we have some campuses that aren't. I mean, that's just the fact with the differing, the variety that we have in our state. One of the struggles that we have, and I have this not just as a legislator, but as a parent, is how do you make your schools safe without feeling and making your kids feel like they're going to school in a jail environment, right? How do we find that balance? And so, you know, that's why I think that from the hardening perspective, right? How do we make sure that we have doors that lock from the inside and not just the outside? How do we have, you know, windows and protective coverings that are bulletproof? Those are things that I think go a long way. But until we really, really look at the root of the problem, when you look at all of these, you know, mass shooting incidents, whether it be in a school setting or somewhere else, the shooter had some serious mental health challenges that hadn't been dealt with. And had they been dealt with, we may not be in this situation. So we have to continue doing everything and more to make sure that we, when we identify a problem, when we identify kind of a problem, you know, students somewhere where they have struggles with their mental health issues, what are we providing the services necessary so that they know that they have that they can seek the help when they need it?
We're talking with Republican State Senator Anitara Flores of District 39, joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. If you have a question for your senator, call in now at 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. You can always post your question on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Let me move over to a bill that you're working on. This is Senate Bill 732. This deals with cosmetic surgery, the industry. You read the series from USA Today that looked at these practices, especially of a particular cosmetic surgeon in Miami. Eight women died in 6 years in these clinics. Did you know anything about this industry and what had been occurring?
Yeah, this whole thing is just so shocking. I'll talk about the clinic specifically mentioned in the article is one that is in my district and is one that is actually pretty close to where I live. When the first incident happened, or at least the first incident that came to my attention, it was a couple years back. And just as a passerby, what surprised me is, you know, you saw the first day this horrible tragedy happened where there was a young mother, actually, she died after going for what should have been a rather simple cosmetic surgery, a beauty surgery. She died. And what shocked me is, you know, a couple weeks go by and drove by in a strip mall. And I looked over and I said, you know, isn't that the same place, but they just changed the name? And sure enough, that's all that had happened. This place, I believe, has changed its name 3 different times.
As it was mentioned in the story, yes.
Just horrible. And so a combination of reporting, you know, just a combination of seeing it firsthand combined with a reporting that was done by a local news station and then finally by USA Today, what we found is that the state has very, very little oversight on this niche business that seems to really be growing, and it's about it's with these cosmetic surgery clinics. So, you know, think of a clinic that, you know, is next to the grocery store at the strip mall. That's where we're seeing the problem.
And Senate Bill 732, is it about tightening those restrictions on who is performing these procedures? How is it protecting patients?
Well, we want to do a combination of things. First and foremost, we need to make it very clear that the Department of Health and the Board of Medicine have a regulatory role over these clinics. Because of, you know, not a small loophole, a gaping hole in the law, these clinics are essentially almost not regulated at all. And so what the reporting showed is that the Department of Health lacks this authority. The Department of Health doesn't even have to, nor at this point can they, get any sort of information when there are adverse incidents that happen at any of these clinics. And part of that, I would say, is just because when laws were originally created as it relates to regulating cosmetic surgery and plastic surgery, no one ever imagined that it would happen outside of a traditional medical setting.
But do you,
and so you've
But do you feel there's going to be any pushback? I mean, reading through, you've got House Speaker Jose Oliva of Miami Lakes, who's not interested in healthcare regulations. Do you think that he's on board with this, or is there going to be pushback?
Well, I'd say, listen, the difference that we have here is that these are regulations to protect someone's life. I've had some very preliminary conversations with the speaker talking about this, and I think that we both agree that there is a place where you can have necessary regulation that is important to save people's lives, because this is not just a South Florida problem. This is really this is a Florida problem. This is a national problem, because six of the eight women, and it was women and some men who died, they're people that didn't come from Florida. They were people who were essentially, recruited to come from other parts of the country because they were, they came because of promises of a quick and easy beauty fix, and what they ended with in tragedy. And so as these stories gain more national attention, Florida risks having trading in its positive tourism view and turning it into something where you've got these butcher shops, quite frankly, that are showing up, and you've got people from around the country coming right to visit South Florida for that. So that's really why this is not just a Miami problem. This is really a Florida problem.
I want to move over to immigration issues, and Senator Joe Gruters, chairman of the Republican Party of Florida, bringing back the proposal, the question about sanctuary cities. You voted against this idea, this proposal last year, but why is this keep popping up, considering, again, that there is no sanctuary city in Florida?
Well, certainly there are some politics at play, and there are some, individuals and some cities and counties that have alluded to perhaps their desire to be a sanctuary of sorts. I'm not on any of the preliminary committees where this bill is going to be heard. I will be in its last committee of reference. And my experience tells me that, generally speaking, by the time that a bill gets to its last committee, it looks very different than what it looked like in its first committee. So this year, the bill is actually being heard this afternoon for its first time. So it's getting its first test, where I imagine that there's going to be a lot of testimony on both sides. I haven't had a chance to review this issue specifically, but I will say that my hesitance comes in the form of making sure that this is just beyond an actual political ploy. If there is indeed some public policy that we need to enforce, to make sure that local governments, if an ICE agent has a warrant out for someone's arrest and they're in the custody of local government, well, I do believe that local government should be working with ICE. But as you mentioned, we haven't really seen that's a problem anywhere. And so if, as the weeks progress and time moves forward, we see that this is a problem that needs to be addressed, well, then, certainly I'll take a look at it. But right now this bill is getting its first preliminary hearing. As we move on over the next couple of weeks, I imagine it will change pretty dramatically.
I wanted to bring up the fact that as we wrap up here, this is your final term, right? Your term limited out.
I do. There's I've been in the legislature. I'm almost embarrassed to say a total of 14 years already. So
We won't do the math. Don't worry.
Don't do the math, please. I've got this session and one session left, and so that's why I see this as an opportunity to tackle on some of these issues that are these are not special interest driven issues. These are issues that where you see real problems in the community and someone needs to fix them. And so that's really what I'm focusing on in my last two sessions, and then ensuring that, particularly when it comes to the issues that are of importance to South Florida, when it comes to education, when it comes to funding our public schools. We didn't get a chance to talk about the district cost differential, but that is something that is that we're going to fix this year. We feel pretty good about it. You know, now's the opportunity. You know, as I've got, you know, just a couple years left, and I need to mentor the new class. You know, this will be an opportunity to, you know, to hopefully leave a positive legacy on our community.
And this is not about diving into the future, but after 2020, I mean, what are your ambitions? What do you do next?
You know, that's I'm hoping that I have opportunities where I can continue to serve the community and be a voice for the issues that I have taken on over my time here. The issue of education generally has always been a strong, strong passion of mine. You know, access to higher education is something, and that's why I highlighted the governor's piece on finishing those last couple of credits, helping students meet that financial need. I also created a scholarship program for kids who were the first in their family to go to college. And so if I have an opportunity to continue to you know, to be a voice on some of these issues, then I'd be happy to look at those opportunities. For right now, we just, you know, we have
two years
left in Tallahassee, and a lot happens up here, as you know very well.
Well, you know what? I'll ask that question again when we get closer to it, I promise. Republican State Senator Anitara Flores, Republican from District 39, again joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Senator Flores, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, still to come, is the seagrass in Biscayne at great risk of disappearing? We're going to hear about a recent report that will share what's happening. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Biscayne Bay has lost a lot of its critically important seagrass. That's according to a new report by Miami-Dade County's Department of Environmental Regulators. Now, the report found chronic pollution is responsible for the seagrass die-off. Biscayne Bay is one of the few places on the planet that's home to all seven species of seagrass. Some county commissioners have ordered new reports to fix the problem. Seagrass recovery is a complicated ecological process that could take several years. Now, we talked with Lee Hefty, Assistant Director for Dade County's Environmental Regulation Department, about this report, and he started off by telling us how critical the problem has become.
So we started looking at water quality data we have for nutrients, and what we discovered is that there's been an increase in nutrients, and there's been different types of seagrass losses over the last 10 or 12 years for different reasons. In some cases, there were algal blooms in the water in southern portions of Biscayne Bay, way down near Manatee Bay and Barnes Sound, that caused the water to not have as much transparency, and the seagrasses decreased in number and eventually died off. In the middle portion in the vicinity of Coral Gables, there's a different type of reaction to elevated nutrients, macroalgae, that you can actually see with the naked eye are growing on top of some of the seagrasses and kind of crowding them out and smothering them out. And then in the Julia Tuttle Basin, we didn't really see algal blooms. We just noticed decreases in seagrass.
Going through the report, it showed that in some places you saw up to 65% loss, in other places 95%?
That's correct. And it's important because I think there might be a misunderstanding, because I know some of the recent headlines were that most of the seagrass in Biscayne Bay is dead. That's actually not true. Most of Biscayne Bay seagrasses are doing really well. Those high percentages are associated with very specific study areas that we focused on. So the areas north of the Rickenbacker Causeway, some of those isolated basins, those areas are suffering from significant decreases in seagrass cover. As you go south of Rickenbacker, most of the eastern half of the bay is actually doing quite well. It's the area around Coral Gables, close to the shoreline, where we're seeing this macroalgae that's outcompeting. And then when you get way down to the southern end of the county in Manatee Bay and Barnes Sound, those isolated basins do have higher percentages of losses.
Why is it important to have a healthy seagrass spread throughout the area? What does that do? How does it help the ecosystem? It help us as well.
Natural systems like Biscayne Bay promote the economy. They're beautiful to recreate in. And they also are very productive for fisheries. And so, you know, we eat from the bay, we play in the bay, and we earn money from people coming to visit us and play in the bay.
How much is climate change playing a role in this?
You know, part of the challenge with producing a report is trying to understand how much it's related to things that we're doing directly, like water quality impacts that may be coming from the canals, or how much is the ecosystem responding to global climatic changes? That's something that actually our report didn't go into a lot of detail on. What we tried to look at is the most obvious things that we're measuring, things that we could have the most immediate impact on. Obviously, global climate change is affecting temperature, weather patterns, and so you see around the world, around the globe, you see these landscape changes happening. And a lot of that is related to significant changes in climate. In this particular case, it's hard to say how much of what we're seeing is related to that. But things we can control are trying to minimize urban runoff and pollution in that regard.
And, you know, talking about that, this is a story that has been discussed quite a bit over the last 6 months, but it's really gotten a lot of attention lately, is the issue of septic tanks.
Yes.
In Miami-Dade. What impact is that having? And how can we deal with that issue?
There was recently a report that the county produced, a septic tank report that actually made a prediction for where septic tanks may be a problem. And so it's important for us and my agency now to work with the water and sewer utilities to look more closely at that prediction to see if we're actually measuring impacts from those areas. What that report did was looked at groundwater elevation and land elevation and predicted places where septic tanks are, where there may not be enough room for a septic tank to function properly. So what we're planning on doing now is doing additional specific studies in those areas to find out where septic tanks may really be a problem, because in the long run, ultimately, especially with the threats of climate change and sea level rise, we're going to have to move everybody on to the sanitary sewer system. But it's important to invest the money and the infrastructure in the places that make the difference the most first.
We're talking with Lee Hefty. He's the assistant director for Miami-Dade County's Environmental Regulation Department. Again, a new report shows there's been a massive die-off of seagrass in Biscayne Bay. Now the county's creating a task force to draft a report for potential solutions to the problem. Where do the studies go next? I know that county leaders are asking for some solutions, but how much more study is on this? What else do we need to understand?
So the thing to do now is to try and see if we can identify the specific sources and the pathway of those sources getting into the surface water and ultimately into Biscayne Bay. The data that we have right now can tell you where Biscayne Bay and some of the canals have higher nutrients, but what it doesn't tell you is what's causing those nutrients. You've heard people say, oh, it must be the septic tanks. It might be, but until I can prove through additional specific studies in areas where those septic tanks might be impacting groundwater and that groundwater impacting surface water, until I can get compelling evidence, it's hard to go to utilities and say, you need to invest the money in this location. And that's exactly what we want to do, because we think that we know in the long run it'll all need to be done, but we want to put the work and the effort into the places that will make the biggest difference first.
Because I'm sure people have come to you and said, hey, what are the solutions? How do
yes.
we fix this?
Yes, and the report actually does talk about that. If you look at the report, it talks about doing more specific studies and then trying to pinpoint the source and the pathway for the nutrients getting into the water in the surface waters, and then working with utilities, whether it's sewer utilities or municipalities with stormwater systems, or we need to be looking at the potential for urban land runoff. Is it coming from fertilizers or something as simple as people blowing their yard clippings into the street, which go into the storm drain, and then they decompose and then they're part of the system? So there's a number of things that we as a society need to think about. And what I want to do with my staff is put a fine point on those activities. And then we can go to the elected leaders and say we either need money for infrastructure and we should start here first, or there might be some policy changes.
Do you get the sense that you are getting that cooperation, especially from the government?
I think there's a tremendous interest in getting additional collaboration. I know the municipalities are very much interested in it. And, you know, as we look for solutions to climate change, we're going to have to figure out how we're going to stay a resilient community and not flood ourselves out. At the same time, we keep this a wonderful place to live.
I come back real quickly to, you know, as you were talking about, you know, where these studies go next. But what are the studies you're doing right now and how long will they take?
There's a tremendous pressure. Elected officials want everything done right away. And I love that commitment. And the challenge with these things are when you go to identify the sources, it may take a while to get the funding and the infrastructure constructed, and then it will take a certain amount of time for that to have a corresponding difference in what you see in water quality. What I'm doing within my own agency is setting up an initiative, create a water resources senior scientist position to be focused specifically on this, to look at the difference or the water quality in groundwater and surface water, and then to develop a collaborative group with the municipalities as well. the task force, there's another resolution by one of our county commissioners to create a Biscayne Bay task force in order to study and get information from researchers and other experts on what the current status of Biscayne Bay is. My goal is to recommend that we develop an action plan. That action plan would also include a ongoing collaboration with all the cities, the county, the municipalities, and interested groups to make sure that we keep this issue in the forefront going forward. This is a wake-up call. This is important for us to realize that there have been some decreases in seagrass in Biscayne Bay, and it's very likely because of the anthropogenic impact of the urban landscape. So going forward, when the time comes that we've put a fine point on the kind of improvements that are needed, when there's a cost or a change in behavior, we really need the community to be around that and behind it.
And again, that was Lee Hefty. He's the Assistant Director for Miami-Dade County's Environmental Regulation Department, and he was talking to us about a new report that shows there's been a massive die-off of seagrass in Biscayne Bay. The county is now creating a task force to draft a report for potential solutions to the problem. All right, still to come, we're going to look at Miami Beach in a different era through the lens of a photographer and a new book that's coming up next on Sundial.
Your warm breath on my shoulder keeps reminding me that it's too soon to forget you. It's too late to be free. Can't you?
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, if you lived in Miami Beach in the 70s, you remember a very different city. It was still a vacation spot, but not to what it is, you know, the extent it is today. And there was a large community of Jewish seniors who could be seen at the beach, at the coffee shops, at the mom and pop shops. It was beautifully documented through the lens of a camera, that of Andy Sweet. The story is part of the documentary film, The Last Resort. There's a book also on the same story called Shtetl in the Sun, edited by Brett Sokol. The book is available in hardback beginning February 19th. And The Last Resort will be screening at the Coral Gables Art Cinema this Saturday at O Cinema. So please check that out. We'll make sure we post that up on our Facebook. Now, we're joined now by Brett Sokol. He's the arts editor for Ocean Drive Magazine and contributing writer on art and culture for the New York Times. Also the co-founder of Letter 16 Press, which you guys published the book, right?
Yes.
All right.
The book Shtetl in the Sun.
I said it right.
Yes, you did. That's our mission here. We're going to teach all of America at least one word of Yiddish.
That's Brett Sokol. Also joining us is Dennis Scholl, co-director of the documentary, joining me in studio. Dennis, great to have you back.
Good to be here.
You know what? I remember when you guys came in talking about the documentary. It's a lovely story because you get to see, for a lot of us, because I was, first of all, very small and young, but I wasn't living in South Florida at the time. So, I didn't know what Miami Beach was like in the late 70s. Real quickly, describe, both of you, paint that picture and tell people who don't know, never knew, what Miami Beach looked like in the late 70s.
Well, you could get a parking space on Ocean Drive really easily.
Uh-oh.
And the porches of each of the hotels were full of elderly Jewish people. It was a time and a place where people were fleeing the winters of the Northeast. They had small pensions, and they could find a place to come down here and spend their golden years in the sun. It's hard to imagine when you think about Ocean Drive and South Beach now, but there was a concentration of the Jewish community that was 75% Jewish, and about 75% of the people were over 70. It's an amazing moment in time.
Brett, the other thing, too, is in looking through the photographs, is that it seemed like, I mean, look, granted, the photographs, that it's weird looking, by the way, at photographs from way back that came from a film, that came from a camera. I'm too used to digital now. But it paints this picture of, I don't know, just a more serene, relaxed kind of place than what it is today.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I thought it was so important to put this book out, and why I'm thrilled that this documentary film also capturing Andy Sweet's work is out now as well, is because it really fills in this chapter of Miami Beach history and really of Jewish culture that I, as a Jew, didn't even really know much about. I think, I moved down to Miami Beach myself in 1999, and I think like so much of the rest of this country, I had a wrong take on what Miami Beach was like before its current renaissance. I mean, we know what Miami Beach was like in the 50s and 60s with the whole Rat Pack and Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin at the Fountain Blue. And we know what happened in the 90s, this this, you know, transformation of South Beach. You know, the fashion industry came here and it became a playground for celebrities, and then, you know, the American Riviera that it is today. But what we didn't really know was what happened in between, particularly in the 1970s. And all we knew, at least all that I heard, was it was, you know, God's waiting room was the phrase that you heard over and over. And when you see these photos, you realize it was just the opposite, that this community of Jews on South Beach, this shtetl, really, were not waiting around to die. They were full of life. They were living. They were loving. They were dancing. They were really grabbing life with gusto.
And tell us real briefly about Andy Sweep, who documented this life. It's really interesting. Also, the camera that he used.
Andy was also working with another photographer he was very close with, Gary Monroe.
Yeah.
And the documentary film, The Last Resort, really gets into the intimate relationship that these two photographers had. Taking a different approach, Gary Monroe was shooting black and white. Andy was shooting color, square format, Hasselblad camera. So they were taking a sort of, you know, looking at things through literally a different kind of lens. But both determined to document this world that existed in the late 70s on Miami Beach, particularly on South Beach, because they knew that it wasn't going to last. They could see this happening. I know Dennis talks about this in the film as well.
Dennis, did Andy try to pose the people in his pictures? Did he get them to pose for the pictures? What was his style?
Well, the marked difference in styles between Gary and Andy. Gary was a classic photographer, very composed, thinking about every shot. Andy was like, lift up camera, crank button, move on. So his shooting style was very casual, and that worked to his favor. People really began to see them there all the time and began to kind of relax around them. Also, you got to remember, there were two nice Jewish boys who had grown up on Miami Beach. And so this was a culture that they were comfortable with, that they were used to being around. And it had a real impact on the kinds of photos that they took and who they took them of.
And what do we know about the size of the collection, Andy Sweet's collection? How many photos did altogether did they have?
Well, interestingly enough, in Andy's case, all of his negatives were lost, and we actually felt that...
I remember you telling me that.
Yeah, we actually felt that for a long time there would never be more Andy Sweet work, but a number of years ago, maybe a decade or so ago, Andy's sister's partner found a box of test prints, which you don't normally keep. You print them, you say, this is where I'm going to go, and then you go into the darkroom and you make final prints. He took the test prints, and with the evolution of computer software, he was able to bring the test prints back to life. And so there's about 1,600 or so works now. How did he do that? Well, you know, he used Photoshop, but what was his reference point? And so he asked Gary Monroe, well, when I'm taking Andy's prints and bringing them back to life, what should I think of? And Gary said, think beach ball.
They're beautiful. Yeah. I love the color. I really do. And again, that's why I made the mention, like, we just live in this world now where so much digital and you can manipulate photographs after the fact. Again, talking with Dennis Scholl and Brett Sokol, Scholl is the co-director of the new documentary film, The Last Resort, which captures Miami Beach's elderly Jewish community from 1977 to 1980. Brett Sokol edited the book Shtetl in the Sun, which the documentary film is based off of. Again, The Last Resort begins screening numerous theaters in South Florida this weekend, and the book comes out February 19th. Brett, when you're going through, Brett, when you're going through all of these pictures, how do you decide the ones that you can use and want to use for the book?
Well, the gentleman that we were talking about, who did amazing restoration work, his name is Stan Hughes, and he spent hour after hour going through every you know, square 12th of an inch, 8th, you know, 16th of an inch to get these photos to look like they originally looked when they were shot back in 1977, 78, 79, 1980. And we use the best of them in this book, Shtetl in the Sun, to tell the story of this community.
How long did that take, by the way?
A long time. but it's done, and I'm really thrilled to have them now immortalized. It's a hardcover book. It's again, we're talking paper and ink, and these were analog photos that were shot on film back in the day. It is a paper and ink book that does it justice.
I'd imagine there got to be photos that, I mean, you didn't get to use, but you thought, come on, you probably could have used them all, right?
Well, funny you should bring this up. There's a lot of fun things happening with Andy Sweet's work. I mentioned this Saturday, February 16th, there's going to be a special event at the Coral Gables Art Cinema, a screening of The Last Resort. Ellen Sweetmoss, Andy's sister, who was intimately involved in his life, will be there, as well as Stan Hughes. In fact, Andy first started shooting photography seriously by essentially showing up, just sort of crashing Ellen's photography class, and he just kept coming, and it took off. So she's got a lot of really wonderful sort of backstories behind a lot of these photos. On Thursday, February 21st, at the Bal Harbour Books and Books, Ellen, myself, and Kareem Tapsch, who's the co-director of The Last Resort, are going to be all getting together and looking at some of these photos. And then, again, the last thing I'll mention is people said, well, what else is there? There's going to be a whole show of Andy Sweet's photography opening Tuesday, March 19th at the Jewish Museum of Florida, right in the heart of South Beach, with lots more of his work.
Dennis, real quickly, should they watch the movie first and then read the book? Which one should come, what order?
No, I think you would benefit from watching the film first and then looking at the photos in the book.
Do both. I'm saying do both.
For sure. But the photos go by in the film fairly quickly because it's a film.
Right.
But the book is really something to be cherished. It's a coffee table book like none other.
His photos are truly amazing. Having seen the film, but you know what? I got the chance to see some of his photos.
And Do both.
I'm looking forward to seeing this book. Again, the hardcover, it's coming out February 19th. The movie, The Last Resort, is screening at the Coral Gables Art Cinema this Saturday and at O Cinema this week. And again, talking about this new book, please, again, check it out. It is, I want to say, Shtetl.
Yes.
Shtetl
the film's the also playing throughout Broward and Palm Beach County as well.
Yeah. So we're going to have that on our Facebook as well. Brett Sokol, arts editor, Ocean Drive Magazine, contributing writer on art and culture for the New York Times, co-founder of Letter 16 Press. Dennis Scholl, co-director of the documentary. Please check them both out. Dennis, Brett, such a pleasure as always. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, we're going to be looking at what it means to be a Miami and micro theater, doing a new series of shows about that question. Coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. What does it mean to be a Miamian? A new series of plays from the Miami Micro Theater explores that idea. Director Lucia Miranda interviewed 60 people from all walks of life and then crafted these plays based on their experiences. The plays are short, 15 minutes each, and they will take place in the confines of a shipping container. Have you done micro theater yet? Because that's how it works. It's tight, small, and short, and really cool. I Am Miami kicks off this Thursday, runs through March 17th. We're joined now by the director, Lucia Miranda, who's visiting from Spain. Lucia, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Great to have you here. So what brought you to Miami? How did you end up here?
Well, the Spanish Cultural Center got a grant from the Nice Foundation, and they wanted to create a project, a documentary theater project based in Miami and the people from the 80s until now. And I have been working all around the world with documentary theater. So they called me, I arrive, and I stay 15 days driving from one side to another to Miami.
Have you ever been to Miami?
I came here when I was a kid with 8 years old with my parents. But to tell you the truth, no, I have been living in New York for 3 years, so I'm used to the States. I used to come to New York, but no, Miami, no.
So you talked to 60 people from Miami.
Yes.
To get their story.
Yes.
What did you want to know from them? What did you ask them?
I asked them where do they feel. I asked them what are their favorite places. I asked them about the challenges that they have passed in Miami. I asked them about how they arrive here. Why? Because there are many people that are all around the world. So I realized that all of them have something in common, that is everybody loves Miami. And it's great. Like, they come from very different communities, different age. I have like kids. I did workshop with kids of 8 years old, 10 years old. I interview women of 80 years old. And their perspective are super different.
And so you created a series of these short plays based on those interviews.
They are the real voices of these interviews. The characters are these real people. I asked them if they wanted to continue with the real name or if they want me to change their name. So from these 60 people, I choose some of them. I choose the juicy stories. I use the juicy parts. And I made them a character. And they are coming the day of the premiere.
Yeah. Something I heard about too as well is the actors who are going to be playing these real people, you have them listen to those. You tape all your interviews.
Yeah,
you have them listen to the tapes.
Yeah.
And you want them to really become this person.
Yeah. This technique is called verbatim theater. And I learned it in New York. Yes, the actors receive the script, but also receive the cuts of the voices of that person that I choose, no, that juicy part, and this the character, the actors have to learn the lines from the sound. It's like a song. You talk, and language is identity, and the way that you speak makes you, makes the pose that you make, everything.
You're trying to, I mean, you want them to, you know, that whatever the dialect, because you have so many different Latinos living here, so they'd get that dialect right.
Yeah.
So you talk about the juicy parts of the stories. Let's talk about one of them in particular. There's one of the plays, one of the stories is called When Miami Was a Party.
Mm-hmm.
This is the story of when Fidel Castro died.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about this story and what's going to happen.
Well, the funny thing is I phoned a drag king. Not a drag queen, a drag king.
A drag king, okay.
She's a wonderful woman that told me that that day she has a show of drag king. And later she knew about the diet of Castro and she went to Calle Ocho. She's from Miami. She was born and raised here. She's white. And she went there with a friend. And is how she lived that party, not being a Cuban person. And also he mixed that story with a Cuban DJ who has he's American, but all his family is from Cuba. And it's these two perspectives of people in their 30s and a party night and how they live that party night from very different perspectives.
That's an that was an interesting night too here in Miami. Any of us who are here, we remember that. As you said, the actors are going to get to meet the people they're portraying. That's Thursday.
Yes.
This is the first time they're meeting them.
Yes. Some of them has come to the rehearsals because we asked them, like the drag king came to help us to make the show, for example. But the rest of them are coming on Thursday and I'm pretty sure that it's going to be a very sensitive night.
Yeah. Something interesting about micro theater is that it really got its start in Spain.
Yeah, in Madrid.
So, I mean, you are accustomed to, you understand this idea of performing these short little stories in a confined space.
I have to say that I have never done before, that I came to Miami to do it for first time. I'm used to big shows, not these little
big
things.
Shows on a big stage with a lot of audience.
Yes, I used to play like for 300 people, 500 people, that the kind of shows that I do. So when they asked me to make this, it was totally a challenge.
So what was it like when you walk up? Because again, so they have, I think it's 6 metal containers.
These Seven.
7 of these cargo containers. These are the cargo they take off the ships. And basically you stuff about 10 people from
15.
The...
15.
You could stuff 15. That would be very tight, by the way.
Yeah.
15 people in there to watch a small little show.
Yes.
So what was it like when you first saw that?
Well, it's very different. It depends on the director, how you stage it. In my case, it's going to be face-to-face. We are not going to have fourth wall. The actors are people, are not doing characters, are playing people. And I think it's very immersive. It's going to be very immersive thing.
Yeah, you know, and having been inside of one of those and seen a show, that's, I think, the fun part about it.
Yes.
Is you're right there with the actor. You're on top of them.
Yes.
Almost. And they are almost on top of you.
Yes, and it's going to be like that. And I think it's going to be a very participatory show. The 7 containers, you can watch them separately.
Do you have to watch them in order?
No.
No?
You can watch, you can go one night and watch one if you just want to have one little piece, or you can watch the 7. And you're going to understand because they are very different stories.
And some are in English, some are in Spanish.
Yeah, that's right.
your experience here, having been around and had the chance to talk to people and get to know Miami, what do you know about Miami? What do you think about it?
Wow, I think many things, because Miami is many different things at the same time. I think it's a very diverse city. I didn't know that it was so diverse. It's very Latino. You can talk Spanish everywhere. The food, the culture also, like working and doing stuff, is super Latino.
Yep.
And something that for me was amazing is how many different communities you have. But sometimes these communities are not melted, are not like...
We are mixing pot, but at the same... Melting pot, but we're also very separated in groups. Yeah, sometimes that's true, yes.
Yes.
Lucia Miranda, again, Spanish director, leading the new series of plays at the Miami Micro Theater beginning this week entitled I Am Miami. They are 7 original 15-minute plays, again, performed in these 7 different shipping containers. That's Micro Theater for you. And you can see the performances every night between Thursday and Sunday beginning at 8 o'clock. Lucia, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And break a leg. By the way, just mentioning, we're listening to a lot of different music today. You've been hearing music from Grammy-nominated artists all from here in South Florida. For those who watched the show last night, right now you're listening to American Dreamers, Voices of Hope, Music of Freedom. John Diversa Big Band featuring DACA artist Jazz Ensemble, which won 3 different Grammys. Congratulations to them. Well, that's our program for today, this Monday, February 11th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.